Prairie Public is turning 60. Join us at the Armory Event Center in Moorhead on Thursday, October 24th to celebrate 60 years of telling the diverse stories of the Prairie region and beyond. Wear your best 60s fashion and enjoy food, drinks, a silent auction, and our special keynote speaker, Darlie Newman, from the public television show Travels with Darlie. Tickets are available at prairiepublic.org/60years.
Welcome to this Thursday, almost the weekend edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A little bit later, Matt Olean stops by. He reviews movies with us each and every week here on Main Street. This week, Matt talks about Megalopolis, the epic movie by Francis Ford Coppola. Matt isn't really a fan, and we'll get his entire review coming up in the second half today. Also in the second half today, both Matt Olean and Dave Thompson will join us for the weekly review of the news and the recent debates that we've hosted here on Prairie Public. It'll be good to catch up with both. But first, we visit with Alicia Underlie Nelson. She joins us periodically here on Main Street to talk about travel, both in North Dakota and around the region. Today, she's in the Black Hills. Alicia Underlie Nelson joins us again on Main Street. She's on a fall excursion in the Black Hills, and we get to visit with her periodically about travel. Alicia, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me. I am having a blast down here.
You just had the rush of a lifetime. Tell us about that.
I did. I had the opportunity to watch the 59th annual Buffalo Roundup, which happens right in the heart of Custer State Park. And they do this at the end of September every year because, I mean, these are wild bison. They're out, you know, the park is their home, and they've got to kind of manage the herd, get them vaccinated, keep them healthy, and make sure that there's enough nutrients to take them through the winter. So a few of them are sent to new homes, but it's so exciting because thousands of people come to watch this. Custer State Park admission is free today. There's no charge to get in. And we got up at 5 in the morning, hopped in, rolled out in the dark before dawn, and there were people that had been lined up maybe for hours, just an endless line of cars and pickups, and everybody was super excited, and it's just incredible. Got a front row seat, talked to a gentleman that had ridden for 53 out of 59 of these rides.
Wow.
It's just amazing, and there's about, they don't have, you know, I was an exact count, that's kind of what this roundup is for, but, I mean, up to 1,500 of these gorgeous, majestic animals. And I have seen bison before, okay? I love going out to Western North Dakota. I've seen them. It's a successful day when I see one or two. I got to watch these extremely talented riders, including South Dakota Governor Noem out with her family. And there's just hundreds, and it just, the sound that their hooves make when they're cresting that ridge, it was absolutely mind-blowing.
I bet you felt it.
Yeah, you really did. And what's wild about it, so there's this vibration, right? This vibration, you hear them coming and you feel them coming before you see them. And then you have all these riders coming up behind, and they're cracking whips, and they're yipping, and they're hollering, and they're kind of moving all these animals in the store. And it's wild because, you know, all of these folks have experience with cattle and with horses, but you get a wild animal in the mix, and they don't always like to do as they're told. So I'm interviewing these people, I mean, who have been around livestock their whole lives, and like, how are they different than cattle? And they're like, oh, they don't care what you do. They're going to do what they want to do when they want to do it. And it's a little dangerous, and it's just an absolute rush. So you can just feel their adrenaline and the adrenaline of the crowd. And I mean, the estimates for how many people come out to this and take advantage of the free, you know, the no park fees, anywhere between, you know, 14,000, 18,000, 20,000 people. Everybody just out, bringing lawn chairs, having a great time, kids in wagons. There's a chuck wagon lunch. It was just a blast and a chance to see so many of these gorgeous creatures at once. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I didn't know what to expect, honestly. I'm a farm girl, but I'm not a ranch girl. I love being out in nature. I wasn't sure how this all would feel, and it's just amazing. It starts at 9:30 a.m., takes them about an hour, and it's just incredible, the the sound and, oh, just the sight of all these gorgeous animals just moving in a big group like that. It's just incredible. I highly recommend it.
They combine an arts festival with the Buffalo Roundup every year.
Yeah. Oh, and that's one of my other favorite things. You know, after you've been out and about, you've gotten your lunch, you've seen the bison up close, then you head on down and there's just booths, I mean, artists from all over. I bought some great earrings. I bought myself a leather bracelet. There was some incredible art. Folks from all over the region ran into some Minnesotans and North Dakotans up that way. So I had to say hi to people from, you know, our part of the world, and just great live music, people milling about. And anytime you can get together and gather, you know, for free and just meet some new people, enjoy some good food. They had ice cream and, you know, popcorn, everybody having something, a little snack. Oh, it was just a blast. And then, of course, the hiking and the nature watching in Custer State Park are second to none. I really think that Custer State Park holds its own with a lot of national parks. It is truly, I mean, I think people are aware of it kind of around our region, but it's one of those best kept secrets. And I kind of want to tell everybody about it, but I also sort of want to keep it close to the vest and make it one of those special places. I don't want too many people to know because it's just so good.
Well, we're letting everyone know about it now, for sure. I noticed a couple of hints for folks that want to come and maybe check this event out next year. It'll be the 60th annual Buffalo Roundup. They encourage you to leave your pets at home, and that's kind of an important thing to remember. Lawn chairs, those are important. Cameras, binoculars, there's different viewing areas. And if you are a rider, you can get online and apply to be a part of this.
You can. It's highly competitive, but they're so talented, and there's so many incredible stories. Riders that come, first-time riders to folks that have done it. As I said, I talked to a gentleman that had done it for decades. The guy that held the flag this year rode it, I think it was either his 13th or his 16th year. I mean, people just love it. So definitely apply. You have plenty of time to plan. So if you want to ride, definitely apply. They say that you really want a horse that, I mean, even the calmest horses can get a little skittish around, you know, the chase cars that are there to protect the riders, all that kind of a crowd. I mean, thousands of people, all those horses, all that adrenaline, all those bison. But, you know, you want a horse that has a good sense of themselves, that can be calm. And then if you want to just attend the event, the brochures say, you know, if you're there by 7 a.m., you should be able to get a good viewing spot. There was just an absolute sea of people setting up their lawn chairs and wagons and strollers for the kids. Definitely bring sun protection and definitely dress in layers because it was hot today, but it's cooler in the morning, and there have been roundups at the end of September where it snows, so it can be anything in between. So definitely check the forecast before you go. And then I would say definitely take advantage of everything that's available in and around the park. You know, a lot of times people go to a state park and they maybe drive the Wildlife Loop Road, which is a key attraction, but maybe they haven't hiked. Maybe this is a great opportunity to do that. Maybe they've stayed in one of the many cities in the northern or southern hills, but they never stayed inside the park. And this is the year that you want to reserve a camping cabin. You know, you have a little time to plan. Make a list of your goals and just really, I mean, it's free that day, so you really might as well go out and enjoy it. And then definitely think about some of the other cities around the area in the Black Hills that you want to enjoy. They all have a very unique character, and there's so much to explore. And it's been fun for me. This is definitely not my first time in the Black Hills, but I'm a little more familiar with the Southern Hills, which is where I am right now, Custer State Park, the city of Custer, Hill City, Keystone, which is right near Mount Rushmore. But I wasn't as familiar with the Northern Hills. So that was really fun for me to kind of dig in and explore Deadwood and see what was going on there, and check out Spearfish Canyon and go hiking, which is absolutely beautiful, and to cruise through Lead and just see, you know, see what's new, see what I've missed, and to take some of those scenic drives, because even the routes that aren't marked as scenic are gorgeous.
It's a beautiful part of our country. Did you hit the fall colors?
Yeah, they're just starting to turn, and the higher the elevation, the more you have. So like Spearfish Canyon, it was really starting to turn a beautiful kind of golden yellow. We saw a few oranges. And Custer State Park, along the road, you know, as the trees arch up above, there was really some good fall color coming along there too. So this is a beautiful time. And I think a lot of times, you know, folks from North Dakota, we think about our summer vacation to the Black Hills. That's tradition for so many of us. But we don't often think about going earlier or later. And this is my first time here in the fall. And I can tell you, I think I like it better than the summer. The temperatures are great, and there's fewer of us out and about. It's still busy. All the restaurants and bars, which are excellent.
All the services are still available then.
Yeah, yep. The only thing that wasn't available, we were in Deadwood, which has this amazing Wild West history. That's where Wild Bill Hickok died. That's where Calamity Jane is buried along with Wild Bill. The only thing that we just missed was they do a shootout reenactment in the street. Mm. You know what? One thing out of about 100 on my list, that's just fine. And you get a little bit better rates in the hotels. You know, you might see some fun specials. And there's just really something for everybody. So definitely come out, explore, and I tell people, take your time in each of the towns and find your favorite, because I'm traveling with a group of journalists from all over the world, and it's really fun to get their perspective on which towns they're enjoying, which activities they like, and how much this area has surprised them, because everybody kind of comes in with a preconception about the American West, you know, where that history was made, where that gold rush history was made, where those gunslingers lived and died. It's so interesting.
You mentioned that you were in Deadwood earlier. That's the very beginning of the George S. Mickelson Trail, which, for folks that don't know, this is a gem in the middle of South Dakota.
It is, and it connects all these different little towns, which is wonderful. So there are people that come and they hike or, you know, bike portions of, you know, the trail from start to finish. There are people that pop on, as I did the last time I stayed in Custer. I just popped on, did, you know, a couple mile or two hike, turned back around. And that also, like, runs right up in front to breweries and restaurants and little shops. So it's kind of that nice combination of nature, which is obviously a huge draw here in the Black Hills, but also that, you know, that small town main street feel that people like. And I really love that, where you can go out, have a morning hike or a day hike, and then you have a great local beer or, you know, have whiskey on the mean streets of Deadwood, where all of these legends have had a glass before you. You know, like, it's so great to have the option to do both. And I think if you're traveling with a group or a family or a bunch of friends, like, there are just so many options. Like, there's something for everybody here. And not every destination can say that.
The Mickelson Trail is 109 miles long. There are 15 trailheads, all which offer parking. There are different hikes that, as Alicia indicated, but people also bike from town to town to town.
Yeah, there's so much to do. And if there's a place you like, you can linger. And it's really wonderful, because I see a lot of, you know, all levels are accessing the trail, which is nice. I think a lot of times people think, oh, if I'm going to do a bike trip, I have to be super fit and I have to get like a racing bike. No, you don't at all. Like, all levels can head out. You can take it at your own pace, and it feels really relaxed. And again, I mean, it's busy here. It's bustling, especially during Roundup weekend. So if you're planning to come next year, make your plans in advance. But it's not like you're going to be, even in the height of high season, you're never going to be shoulder to shoulder. You're never going to be bumping tires with someone on the trail, which is nice.
And the other way to do this, my wife and I have e-bikes, right? The grade of the Mickelson Trail, if I recall, doesn't exceed 4%. It's a flat trail. There are 100 converted railroad bridges, several rock tunnels, three or four, and the trail is primarily crushed limestone. It is an easy, beautiful, beautiful ride. So, all right, Alicia, here you are. You're in the Black Hills. What else might not be on our radar generally did you really, really enjoy?
That I really, really enjoy. Well, you know, I stopped into Hill City yesterday and popped into the Alpine Inn, which has the teeniest dinner menu I've ever seen. Basically, two sizes of steak or some spätzle. And I'm sorry, my German is my worst language. But they have a giant dessert menu, so I had an absolutely epic pastry. And then I really like Hill City because, you know, I have a soft spot for art, as we've just discussed, and there's lots of really fun little galleries, wineries, fun little boutiques and shops. So that can be fun. You know, you got to counter your nature with a little commerce sometime, a little art. So that's fun. If you've never been to the Black Hills, of course, you must see Mount Rushmore. But I also encourage people, make a stop at Crazy Horse. They have made such progress on the Crazy Horse Memorial carving. We had the honor of talking to the grandson of the gentleman that actually started the project, who is now the lead carver. And the technological advancements that they have made just in the last few years, they are making visible progress, and it's so cool. Lakota history and Indigenous history in this region is so deep and so rich. So it's very cool to see one of the most famous warriors really taking shape before our eyes on this mountainside. But they also have tours where they can take you up to the top, which is really neat. I had never done that before. And they have an absolutely incredible museum, which is dedicated to Native art and culture, as well as a university right there on campus. So it's really interesting. And if you have any interest in history or art or culture, it's definitely, definitely worth a stop. And I think sometimes people don't get to that until their second visit. Definitely make it your first. Personally, I like it more than Mount Rushmore, personally. It's just a different, richer, more cultural experience, which I think is great.
There are a couple different ways that we can get there from our homes here in eastern North Dakota. What's your favorite way to travel to the Black Hills?
You know, my favorite way is to cruise down south, but I like to stop and see the waterfalls in Sioux Falls, and then get some ice cream, take a little break, and then you basically head straight west. And then you can either stop at Badlands National Park, which I also hugely recommend. It's very different than the Badlands in North Dakota. The basic composition of the rocks is similar, but the look is really different. I think Badlands looks almost lunar, almost alien, like it's kind of like a Mars landscape. It's really strange, gorgeous, and very different from the Black Hills. So definitely stop there. You definitely have to get your fill of kitsch at Wall Drug. You don't have to worry about where Wild Drug is. It will, the signs will tell you.
You'll be led there.
Into the parking lot. You will see vehicles from all over the country. You will be absolutely overwhelmed with stimuli, and that's fine. That's fine. You should get a donut, have some coffee, feel pleasantly overwhelmed, and then you just go ahead and you push west. You stop in Rapid City. Maybe you stay in Rapid City. Maybe you push onward into the hills. Either way, there's so much to see or do. Basically whatever you're interested in. But I definitely encourage people to stop along the way. And I really love that east to west stretch through South Dakota. I think it's a blast. But you can also go, lots of the South Dakota folks, if they go to Fargo, they like to push through and check out western North Dakota and visit Theodore Roosevelt National Park. So there's really not a bad option. You can do either way, or you can go up through Bismarck as well.
What's on your travel docket for the rest of this fall and early winter?
The rest of the fall and early winter, I am very excited to go back to Wisconsin. I've been in Wisconsin and Ohio quite a lot in the last couple of years, which has been fun. So I'm going to go to Madison. They have a really wonderful farmer's market there that I'm eager to check out, like absolutely huge. And I really like how that city does such a good job of integrating outdoor recreation into urban life. I love that. That's one of my passions, and I know you're with me there, which is fun. And then I'm really hoping to get my cousin plays hockey in Germany, so we're building a German itinerary as we speak. So we're really excited to do a multi-generational trip to Germany and maybe explore Austria, perhaps check out the Czech Republic. The great thing about Europe is that everything is so close, and flights and rail are very cheap and very convenient. So once you're there, you have so many options. So sometimes that's one of my favorite things to do for Europe. Hot tip, because it is so easy to get from city to city, especially, you know, those major transportation hubs in a country, you can sometimes find an absolutely great deal to a country that maybe wasn't on your radar, that's maybe connected to or a country or two away from your ultimate destination, and really extend your trip in a fun and interesting way. I did Eurorail a couple years ago, connecting Portugal, France, and Spain, and it was just a blast. It's not just for backpackers. It's not just for broke college students and high school kids. Anybody can enjoy it, and it's very flexible and so easy to use. The Europeans have train travel down to a science. We have so much to learn.
We do with train travel, as I've talked about before. Are you worried about going there in wintertime versus a warmer, more maybe climate nice part of the season?
I'm not, to be honest with you. One of my favorite things to do in Germany especially is to check out the Christmas markets. I think Germany is magic when it's snow covered. And if you're from North Dakota, you're going to weather winter in Germany just fine. One of my proudest moments was when a woman was showing me around the Christmas market, and she works in tourism, right? So her job is to, like, walk with us as long as we can go. And she said, I'm so sorry. I need to take a break. How aren't you cold? And I said, look, I'm from North Dakota. I am layered up. I could stay out here all day. And, you know, German weather, it gets cold. It's a little grayer than it is here, but, like, temperature-wise, North Dakotans are absolutely tough enough to hack it. We're just fine. So you wear your layers, you bundle up, you hit the Christmas markets if you happen to go during that season. You drink wonderful mulled wine and cocoa, and you listen to music, and you mingle with people, and they have heaters all over the place. But the mountains are beautiful and covered with snow. Travel all over Europe in every season. And honestly, I think it's easier than Spain in August, which I've done twice now, and I know better. I don't know why I keep doing this. So winter, I think, is sometimes easier than summer. So don't feel like summer is the only time to travel. We have so many options.
Yeah, pro tip, don't, in my opinion, go to Europe in August. They have this thing called summer holiday. We found more difficult to get around in that time of year. I agree with you. There's many other times that are worthwhile to explore.
Absolutely. The Europeans get much more vacation, usually 4 weeks standard. So they take all of that in bulk. And it's very common to find, especially major urban centers where it gets hot. People have, you know, their lake homes or their mountain homes or their second homes, or they're traveling themselves. So, yep, you can get a price break in August. You definitely can. But you may find that, you know, Paris or Berlin or Madrid are a little emptier than you would like. So sometimes that shoulder season, you know, a little bit like right before school starts, a little bit right after, gives you a little bit more flexibility. But prices are really quite flexible through winter as well. They'll spike right around the holidays, which makes sense. We're all going to and from somewhere. But if you have a little flexibility, you know, November, December, even early January, we're tough. We can definitely handle winter anywhere. So I'm not worried about us at all.
Alicia Underlee-Nelson, she joins us periodically on Main Street. She's a freelance writer, photographer, and she specializes in immersive travel stories, hidden history, outdoor adventures, art, street food, beer, and we learned also today a little whiskey every now and then. Alicia, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for having me. And when in Deadwood, go for the whiskey. I've been listening to your show on the radio,
and you seem like a friend to me. You're listening to Prairie Public right now, so I bet you're a bit of a news junkie, right? But do you also like music? Well, I bet you do. Prairie Public is the place for that, too. Did you know that we have a guy named Mike Olson who spins adult album alternative music during the week? There goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play. He's got an endless library, limitless musical knowledge, and a clever way of handcrafting sets of songs. You can listen to Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream on an app or a smart speaker pretty much anywhere, and on an HD radio anywhere in the region. Check out Mike Olson on Prairie Public weekdays from 9 a.m. to 10 and noon to 6 p.m.
Coming up after the break, we'll review the movies like we do each and every week here on Main Street. It is Thursday, and Madeline will stop by. This week, Matt reviews the movie Megalopolis. And Madeline will join Dave Thompson and me as we review this week's news and also talk about the debates that we've hosted and are upcoming right here on Prairie Public. All of that's ahead on Main Street. We're glad you're listening. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating 70 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
We've heard the fanfare. That means it's Thursday, and it's time to go to the movies with our great movie reviewer, Matt Olean. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
We're going to talk about the tragic death of Maggie Smith and Kris Kristofferson, Matt, a little bit later. But this week, you're going to review Megalopolis, the movie. Let's listen to the trailer.
My plan is a city that people can dream about.
Megalopolis.
What about those standing in your way? You like it the way it is.
People don't need dreams.
People need help now.
Don't let the now destroy the forever.
We're in need of a great debate about the
future.
Enjoy the show.
1, 2, 3. Yippee-yay.
Go.
Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis.
All right, Matt, this seems like an ambitious movie to me for sure. Melds the themes of utopia and dystopia. How did that work for you?
So ambitious is exactly what it is. Francis Ford Coppola has had this idea for years to make this kind of crazy movie about the decline of American society. And you can interpret this film any way you want. If it's kind of a commentary on today's society and the decline of society, that's what he's going for. But I think the only reason to see this movie for anybody is if you're a Coppola completist like me. You know, this could be his last movie. I don't think it's quite the disaster, a critical disaster. It's certainly a financial disaster, without question. It made $4 million over the weekend, and the word of mouth is going to kill it. I think it'll be out of theaters by next weekend. But as far as a critical disaster, I don't think it's quite the critical disaster some are making it out to be. It looks great. The production design is great. You feel like you're in this weird modern utopian city, kind of this modern Rome, and the characters' names are Caesar, played by Adam Driver. The mayor's name is Cicero, played by Giancarlo Esposito. There's another character named Crassus, played by John Voight. So they have Roman-sounding names. So it's almost this parallel between the decline of Rome and the decline of American society. So it looks great. The architecture is great. The editing is interesting. It feels like a German expressionist film from the 1920s. Memories of Metropolis and the best work of F.W. Murnau. But within that is this narrative structure. And there's not a lot of room for the actors to act. And the film bounces around so pell-mell, so willy-nilly, that I think that his message gets obscured, right? You're watching this movie and you're kind of like, whoa, what am I watching here? It's like an acid trip of some sort. And the film jumps around so rapidly between scenes. Some of the dialogue is laughable. And this is coming from a guy who has 3 screenplay Oscars, Coppola. I would say the film starts pretty promising. You know, I was into it the first 15, 20 minutes. It looks good. You keep hoping it's going to be like a Fritz Lang's Metropolis, kind of this futuristic city, decline of society, utopian society. You keep hoping that's what it's going to be, this crazy masterpiece like Lang's Metropolis was. But within an hour, I'm begging to get out of that theater. It became boring, and the way Coppola directs it is just I think the wrong way to go about a movie like this. It's too experimental. It's laughable in parts. John Voight gives one of the worst performances you're going to see this year. He's probably going to get a Razzie. He's terrible. Adam Driver does his level best. He's a wonderful actor. I like him. Natalie Emmanuel plays the daughter of the mayor, who's kind of obsessed with Caesar. Caesar's this character who wants to build this new society, Craig, this utopian society. So there's a lot of themes from Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, very similar themes to those books. This visionary guy who's fighting against the system. But in the end, it all doesn't work because the narrative structure is so crazy. It's so crazily constructed, Craig, that the message gets lost. And I would say, even though it looks good and feels good, like the production design, even Coppola doesn't pass the boring test, the Jack L. Warner test of, is my butt squirming in this seat? You know, Frank Capra's rule, don't make a boring film. So it's like you're watching a 2 hours and 18 minute long experimental movie, which typically those are like 5 minute films at film festivals, you know? So I think it's a pretty epic disaster for Coppola, but there's good things in it. It's just that the screenplay needed work, and I think the way he directs the film, the way he edits the film, is really the issue here too.
Matt, how does it work? Give us some behind the scenes relative to, you mentioned earlier, this will be out of theaters really soon.
Mm-hmm.
Don't theaters know like well in advance what their plans are going to be, what their schedules are going to be?
So this was not, Coppola was having trouble getting distribution, okay? He took it to the Cannes Film Festival where he got wildly divergent views on this movie. Some people booed it. I heard a comment from somebody saying it's almost like he'd never directed a movie before. You're watching a movie by a guy who's never directed a movie. And this guy directed Godfather 1 and 2 and Apocalypse Now. So it's like, how can you go from the highs of his career to this in one career? The same guy. And it's crazy. That's what movie making is. It's just, you have these highs and lows. So he had to really fight to get distribution, Craig. And finally, I think they relented and said, okay, let's show it. Let's see what people think. Coppola's the director. Let's give him a pass. And there were three people in the theater when I saw it Saturday. So there's just no audience for a movie like this. Where's the audience for a almost two and a half hour experimental film with kind of middling acting and sometimes bad acting? You know, Shia LaBeouf's in it. He's not very good in it. Aubrey Plaza, she's kind of good in it. She kind of plays Caesar's mistress, who's also the mistress of the mayor. And she's always entertaining to watch. But the way Coppola directs the film, there's really no chance for any actors to shine except for maybe Adam Driver in a different kind of scenario. So they took a chance. They released it. It's a bomb. It's a disaster at the box office. And, you know, Coppola's going to have to live with this.
All right, Matt, we talked earlier about Maggie Smith and Kris Kristofferson. Let's go with Kris Kristofferson first. It's sad that that he's gone now.
Yeah, he became a movie star. You know, he's a songwriter. That's what he's known for. Great songs like Me and Bobby McGee and Help Me Make It Through the Night. But he kind of became a film star in the early 70s, kind of playing a version of himself, kind of this laid-back Texas guy. But he got some juicy parts. You know, he played Billy the Kid and Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. He got to be in A Star is Born with Streisand, a part that was kind of intended for Elvis, but it didn't work out. His lone villain role was in Lone Star, John Sayles' film Lone Star. So a pretty solid actor, interesting guy. And, you know, Maggie Smith, and what can you say about her? Two Oscar wins, a favorite here at PBS and, you know, Prairie Public for Downton Abbey.
Sure, sure.
She just was amazing. An amazing actress. She won the Oscar for The Prime of Miss Jean Brody in 1969, and then another Oscar for California Suite in 1978. But the kids know her too, right? Because of Harry Potter, Professor McGonagall. So her fame extended into younger people because of Harry Potter. So, you know, both had good long careers, and we say goodbye to them.
All right, Matt, let's go to our Oscar trivia part of the show. You mentioned John Voight earlier.
Of course.
He has won an Academy Award Best Actor for the movie Coming Home. It was also nominated for Best Picture in 1979, but it didn't win. Which picture won?
The Deer Hunter.
What other pictures were nominated?
Let's see. Midnight Express, Heaven Can Wait, and An Unmarried Woman.
Well done, Matt. I've got a story about Midnight Express. I was a sophomore in high school, had nothing to do, mm-hmm. went to the bookstore, got the book, and I read that thing cover to cover on New Year's Eve of my sophomore
year.
Wow. And then I enjoyed when it became a movie.
An intense movie for sure.
Yes, it was. We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
Tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl. This free event is October 5th and 6th, noon to 6 p.m. See new and returning artists demonstrating their work. New destinations this year include the Indigenous Art Collaboration at the Plains Art Museum, and the Rourke Art Gallery is offering tours of their public access print studio and hosting several area artists in their courtyard outside. Find the studio crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
Here's the walk-up music for Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's long-standing news director. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig.
And we have another guest with us today. Matt Olean stays with us here after his movie review. Matt, you had a chance to moderate a debate last night, and I wanted your take about how you think the debate went. You had the North Dakota U.S. Senate debate that was aired on the television service of Prairie Public and also on our radio service between Republican Kevin Cramer and Democrat Katrina Christensen. What was your take, Matt, from the debate?
I think it was a good one. Both candidates, I think, are pretty skilled debaters. They're both, you know, had their talking points ready. They had responses ready. I thought it was very good. I don't know what Dave thought, but I Dave was there with me, of course.
Uh-huh.
But you know, we don't want to get into too much of, you know, it's not my job to say, you know, who one or whatever like that. I mean, people are going to vote for how they're going to vote, but I think we try to keep it fair, present the voters with the contrasting of the two candidates. I think there was a lot of contrast there. I think both come off really good on camera, in my opinion.
Yes.
And not everybody does. It's one of those things that we've found through the years doing debates is it really helps if you're camera ready. And that's just the nature of the business. If you're listening on radio, you don't quite understand that, but it is an important fact. Like we saw it with the Vance Walls debate the other night, where the general opinion is that Walls was maybe a little unprepared compared to Vance, who's very, very polished on television. And I don't think that was the case with Christensen and Kramer. They're both, I think, really good with the issues. Christensen has said she's been to all 53 counties, and that's how you win elections in this state. You have to get out there and meet the people in order to win.
Retail politics.
Yes, for sure.
Matt, I thought that it was good of you to ask their opinions on something like Measure 4, which obviously is not a federal issue, but it's really important to the state, and each of them chose to answer, which was also enlightening to me.
Senator Kramer said he's undecided on how he's going to vote for this, which I thought was interesting. You know, there are a lot of undecideds out there if you look at the poll numbers that came out today with the measures and the races, and Christensen's going to vote no on Measure 4. But Dave and I both thought that's a big enough issue, I think, right now in this state, even though a senator from North Dakota really has not much to do with local property tax levies. We wanted to get them both on the record.
Mm-hmm. We did.
Matt, what was your takeaway about how responsive each of the candidates were? You did mention, and I heard, that each of them had their somewhat polished rhetoric that they were ready to dish out. But it seemed to me in the part of the debate I was able to listen to that you got answers to your questions.
Yeah, I think they did answer the questions for the most part. I think that's important. We've seen in some debates where someone gets asked a question and they start talking about something completely different. Mm-hmm. And you have to really, as a moderator, pay attention to what they're saying. Because if they're not answering the questions, then Dave and I will follow up. Or, you know, I have an earpiece on last night. Dave might say in my ear, you know, he really didn't answer that question. Ask him again about Social Security or whatever. They both veered off into tariffs, too. I think the tariff issue is something that we asked in the Fedorchuk-Hammer debate, too. This is kind of becoming a big issue, I think, in some of these federal races, is what's going to happen with tariffs if Donald Trump beats Kamala Harris. Because, you know, that they were definitely there when he was president. And I know it can affect farmers. It can affect businesses. So this is something we're going to keep an eye on going forward in the next couple of debates, too.
Dave, give us your feedback on last Thursday, September 26th debate. That was, of course, the North Dakota U.S. House debate between Republican Julie Fedorchuk and Democrat Trigby Hammer.
Well, my takeaway was that both did, I think, very well. Trigby, it took him a little while because, you know, I don't think he's been on a debate stage like that. But he did come off very well, I thought, and he had very short, very succinct answers. And as a matter of fact, we were thinking about that, you know, we gave him a minute for an answer, and he didn't take a minute all the time, but he did come up with a succinct, honest answer.
All right. We've got debates ahead of us. The October 8th debate coming up is the Minnesota 7th District Congressional debate. Matt, you'll have that debate.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Fischbach and A.J. Peters. And it would appear now that since she defeated Colin Peterson in 2020, that she's in a pretty secure position in the 7th District. At least that's my sense of it, talking to people. A.J. Peters, I have not seen an ad. I've not seen anything like that out there. You know, with Katrina Christensen, you are seeing TV ads. So there is some money behind Christensen this time that I'm noticing as well. She's got people working for her that, you know, have done this before. But Fischbach appears to be in a strong position. But we've done the Minnesota 7th District debate ever since 1998 when I first was hired here. I suggested to Bob Dambach, you know, we have a big TV audience in Western Minnesota, and that 7th District is huge geographically. It's huge. And Peterson was in a strong position through most of those debates. I don't know how many debates I did with Colin, but it was a lot, you know, at least 10. But we'll have that Tuesday night for sure.
Are questions different, Matt, before we let you go here, or this Minnesota congressional district versus, say, North Dakota's congressional district?
A little. You know, sugar beets are an enormous, the sugar industry is a big, big deal in the 7th District. It's probably more of a driving economic force in Western Minnesota than it is in North Dakota, even though, of course, there are beet farmers in North Dakota. But Peterson, when he was in Congress, really focused that he was on the Ag Committee. Now, Fischbach is not on the Ag Committee, and this has been a lot of pushback from Democrats in the 7th District that she is not on the Ag Committee, and Peterson was. So that's probably one thing you'll hear is the you know the sugar industry in Minnesota and what that is. But some of the things are similar. You know, we have AARP questions, you know, immigration, inflation. Those are huge issues all across the country. So some will be similar, but some will be different.
And next Thursday, of course, Dave, you have the gubernatorial debate.
Right.
We're all looking forward to that.
Yes, that's going to be interesting. And of course, it's going to be three candidates this time. I get the three-ring circus.
We'll look forward to that. Again, on Tuesday, October 8th, Matt O'Lean will moderate the Minnesota 7th Congressional District Debate. And on Thursday, October 10th, Dave Thompson will moderate the gubernatorial debate for those candidates here in North Dakota. Thank you both. Dave, you and I will continue on to review the news. Thanks, Matt.
You bet.
Dave, Stetson County has received a $5.86 million donation for its courthouse.
And this is an 1883 courthouse that was built. There was some movement in the early 1980s, mid-1980s, that they may want to tear it down, but a group formed in Stutzman County to keep the courthouse because of the historic value of it. And they were successful in doing that. Now there's a $5.8 million grant, or shall we say a legacy, that will go into that courthouse to make it a little bit more friendly for visitors to come by. They're going to put in air conditioning, for example.
Was that a surprise donation?
That size of a donation, they knew something was coming from this farmer, but they didn't know it was going to be that big.
Dave, the Southwest Water Authority returned $100 million to the state's Resources Trust Fund.
Now, this is a story I've been covering for years. When the proposal was first made to bring Missouri River water from Lake Sakakawea to southwest North Dakota, they were going to build canals. But there wasn't enough appetite in the legislature to do that. So they came back and they said series of pipelines, and that would do it. And I went to those hearings early in the day when we had people who lived in that area who were using well water would come into a legislature with a jar with brown and maybe even black water. Mm-hmm. And that helped push that over the finish line.
Lastly, Dave, the Industrial Commission has approved three renewable natural gas projects.
These are very interesting. A lot of our demonstration projects and about using waste streams to provide what they're calling renewable natural gas that can provide power to those manufacturing plants, especially in that sugar beet plant in Hillsboro. And the natural gas could also be sold off because there is a demand for natural gas in North Dakota.
Dave, what's your team working on for the next few days?
Hey, I have a fun story. I call it fun, but next week I'll have a story about how a number of North Dakota cities are working to replace their water meters.
All right, we'll look forward to that each and every week. Dave Thompson and I review North Dakota's news. Dave, thanks for joining us again on Main Street.
Thanks, Craig.
Gather round, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story about a little fella.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 3rd. 1902 saw the introduction of a new sport in the United States when a turtle race took place in Chicago. This so-called sport became very popular in the 1920s. Gangster Al Capone took note of the popularity and realized he could introduce them into his speakeasies as an indoor betting event. In 1930, he bought 5,000 racing turtles for his saloons. The popularity of turtle racing continued into the 1930s Great Depression as a cheap form of entertainment. It became a common pastime in bars, and the popularity still continues. In 1975, the owner of Brennan's Bar in Florida introduced turtle racing as a joke, but it became so popular that the races are still held today. On this date, in 1933, a highly anticipated race was held at Turtle Raceway in Washburn, North Dakota, during the McLean County Stock Show. The stands were packed with eager spectators. It was a great deal of excitement as the competitors approached the starting line. It was a large field, 150 turtles, each with a number painted on its shell. Placed in the middle of a 100-foot circle, the first turtle to reach the perimeter would be the winner. The turtle set off at a blistering pace. Number 40 took the lead and looked like an easy winner. Unfortunately, Number 40 fell asleep just shy of the finish line. Turtle 18 streaked past for the win, covering the 50-foot course in 5 minutes. The winner missed the record time by 30 seconds. Number 28 came in second. Number 40 finally woke up long enough to streak across the finish line in third. The three top turtles each received $8 in prize money. Turtle racing continued at the fair, but gradually faded from the schedule. Nevertheless, North Dakota turtle racing fans need not despair. Turtle races still make appearances at local fairs and special events. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. In the UK, for years, milk was delivered to your front door in bottles with foil caps. Great Tits, a common songbird in the UK, learned how to peck through the foil to get at the cream. The skill spread. But how? To find out, researchers launched a series of experiments. Males from different subpopulations were captured, trained in one of two different but equally effective ways of opening a box to get food, and re-released into the wild. Knowledge of how to open the box spread rapidly within 20 days, and most of the birds that learned the trick did it the same way the trained bird in their group did. Clearly, they learned how to open the food box by observing others that already knew how to do it. What's more, when birds moved between different cultures, they learned the prevailing way to open the box in their new community. Social conformity is a powerful force for birds as well as people. But when the researchers did a follow-up experiment and changed one method of opening the box to be more effective, nearly half of the birds switched to the more effective method in just 14 days. It seems that great tits can stand up to peer pressure if they see there's a better way of doing things. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
25 years after writing his famous book, The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell says he's changed.
I'm not as sunny and full of possibility as I was back then.
So he re-examined his book about social epidemics and rewrote it more darkly. An idea re-examined tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Thursday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spend time with us here at Prairie Public. Coming up tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy will ask the question, what's the single most important issue to you this election? And at 7 p.m., we'll air Science Friday with Ira Flatow. Monday on Main Street, we'll visit with Jim Townsend, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for European and NATO Policy, in front of an event that's happening Tuesday at Concordia College. The event is a public event as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization celebrates its 75th anniversary this year. The event is titled NATO at 75, Reflections, Relevance, and Future Challenges. It's set for 7 o'clock on Tuesday, October 8th, in Barry Auditorium inside the Grant Center of the college's Offutt School of Business. Jim and I will not only talk about that event, but also many, many different topics relative to NATO. Is the future of NATO dependent on our upcoming elections? Why should we in North Dakota care about NATO? That's coming up Monday on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.